novel, and it all takes place on one night. And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave or the crypt on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time. And I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo was a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death. And there are several others, but the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation, but if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that, and then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of a almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form, and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't say decided, unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think... for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I've learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around, trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologues, partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is, bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell the story. It almost looks like a screenplay, some people said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to... a tactile form, but it certainly doesn't. Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe 2 or 3 distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn and, you know, a southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do so. We had this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors, and she actually went off and made a spreadsheet, and she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors, and then some voice actors, and then some people from Random House, and my agent, and then we got my family members, and so we just barely made the 166, but there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally, and then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So there's quite a list. Maybe, probably, I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually.
That's right. right. They were never in the same. None of us were in the studio at the same time, and I think they ended up using. I think she told me 11 different locations. She would Skype. You know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So it was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet, but yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read, well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it lively for the audience.
Now, let's note, you said you wrote short stories. You're described as the master of the short story. So it's a missed opportunity if I don't ask you this. RNIB have a writing competition each year. What are some top tips you would give to people who are potentially thinking about entering that competition?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I think, for me, the big leap forward was when I realized that a short story is not necessarily... how would I say it? It's a strange little machine that we make. It's almost like a song or a poem. It has a resemblance to real life, but it isn't necessarily a linear representation of real life. So, or the other comparison would be to a joke. You know, a joke often doesn't have much to do with real life. It isn't. You know, it's more compressed and it's sillier. When you're telling the joke, you're really concentrating on the last moment, you know. When you get to the punchline, if the person laughs, then you win, and if they don't, then you lose. So the story is a very similar medium, actually. There's usually one moment in the story that's kind of the payoff moment, and nothing else really matters except for that payoff. So to me, it was very useful to think of it as a kind of a machine, a strange little device that's there to, you know, to create human emotion. The other more quotidian thing would be just that most of the story writers I know who are good, they just do a lot of revision. You know, it's not the case that they just blur something out, but you do blur something out, and then you go back to it again and again and again and try to find what it is really trying to say to you. And that's just a kind of a, you know, a sweat equity sort of a thing. You're really doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rewrites to try to let the story talk to you directly.
How many times did you go back to and rewrite Lincoln and the Bardo?
It would be hard to count. It was a 4-year effort, and every section was rewritten, you know, at least dozens of times, and then whole sections were taken out and put back in, and things were moved around. And so it was kind of a, you know, I'm sure thousands of drafts. I like that the model of writing that is, you know, kind of led by iteration. So you keep coming back to it every day, and gradually it changes shape into what you like. The example I always use is if you had a hotel room, or let's say that I gave you an apartment, I bought it for you and gave it to you, and I furnished it nicely. Although that would be a nice gesture, you would go into the apartment and you wouldn't feel at home. This isn't your style. So revising is like if I let you, you know, every day for 3 years, take out one thing that I bought for you and exchange it for something that you like better. You know, all the pictures, all the knickknacks, the blankets, everything in the house. After that 3 years, the place would have you in every cranny. You know, you would have totally infused that room with yourself. Rewriting is like that. You know, you throw down a first draft, that's kind of like that initial apartment. But then every day when you come back and make changes to taste, the thing starts to really have your essence in it. For me anyway, I can't do that unless I work on something for years and years over and over.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.